Chapter 105. Had an instinctive knowledge that there was not the least truth in it, but it had an influence in placing obstacles in the way of her association with Mrs. Gowan, by making the Prunes and Prism School excessively polite to her, but not very intimate with her, and little Dorrit, as an enforced sizer of that college, was obliged to submit herself humbly to its ordinances. Nevertheless, there was a sympathetic understanding already established between the two, which would have carried them over greater difficulties, and made a friendship out of a more restricted intercourse. As though accidents were determined to be favorable to it, they had a new assurance of congeniality in the aversion which each perceived that the other felt towards Blandois of Paris, an aversion amounting to the repugnance and horror of a natural antipathy towards an odious creature of the reptile kind. And there was a passive congeniality between them, besides this active one. To both of them, Blandois behaved in exactly the same manner, and to both of them his manner had uniformly something in it, which they both knew to be different from his bearing towards others. The difference was too minute in its expression to be perceived by others, but they knew it to be there. A mere trick of his evil eyes, a mere turn of his smooth white hand, a mere hair's breadth of addition to the fall of his nose, and the rise of the mustache in the most frequent movement of his face, conveyed to both of them, equally, a swagger personal to themselves. It was as if he had said, "I have a secret power in this quarter. I know what I know." Apostrophe, this had never been felt by them both in so great a degree, and never by each so perfectly to the knowledge of the other, as on the day when he came to Mr. Dorrit's to take his leave before quitting Venice. Mrs. Gowan was herself there for the same purpose, and he came upon the two together, the rest of the family being out. The two had not been together 5 minutes, and the peculiar manner seemed to convey to them, "You were going to talk about me. Ha! Behold me here to prevent it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Gowan is coming here?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Blandois, with a smile. Mrs. Gowan replied he was not coming. Not coming. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Blandois. Permit your devoted servant, when you leave here, to escort you home. Apostrophe, thank you. I am not going home. Apostrophe, not going home. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Blandois. Then I am forlorn. Apostrophe, that he might be, but he was not so forlorn as to roam away and leave them together. He sat entertaining them with his finest compliments and his choicest conversation. But he conveyed to them, all the time, "No, no, no, dear ladies. Behold me here expressly to prevent it." Apostrophe, apostrophe, he conveyed it to them with so much meaning, and he had such a diabolical persistency in him, that at length, Mrs. Gowan rose to depart. On his offering his hand to Mrs. Gowan, to lead her down the staircase, she retained little Dorrit's hand in hers, with a cautious pressure, and said, "No, thank you. But, if you will please to see, if my boatman is there, I shall be obliged to you." Apostrophe, it left him no choice, but to go down before them. As he did so, hat in hand, Mrs. Gowan whispered, "He killed the dog." Apostrophe, does Mr. Gowan know it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, little Dorrit whispered, "No one knows it. Don't look towards me, look towards him. He will turn his face in a moment. No one knows it, but I am sure he did." "You are?" Apostrophe, I think so, apostrophe, little Dorrit answered. "Henry likes him, and he will not think ill of him. He is so generous and open himself. But you and I feel sure that we think of him as he deserves. He argued with Henry that the dog had been already poisoned when he changed so, and sprang at him. Henry believes it, but we do not. I see he is listening, but can't hear. Goodbye, my love. Goodbye." Apostrophe, the last words were spoken aloud, as the vigilant Blandois stopped, turned his head, and looked at them from the bottom of the staircase. Assuredly he did look then, though he looked his politest, as if any real philanthropist could have desired no better employment than to lash a great stone to his neck, and drop him into the water flowing beyond the dark arched gateway in which he stood. No such benefactor to mankind. Being on the spot, he handed Mrs. Gowan to her boat, and stood there until it had shot out of the narrow view, when he handed himself into his own boat and followed. Little Dorrit had sometimes thought, and now thought again as she retraced her steps up the staircase, that he had made his way too easily into her father's house. But so many and such varieties of people did the same, through Mr. Dorrit's participation in his elder daughter's society mania, that it was hardly an exceptional case. A perfect fury for making acquaintances on whom to impress their riches and importance, had seized the house of Dorrit. It appeared on the whole, to Little Dorrit herself, that this same society in which they lived, greatly resembled a superior sort of Marshalsea. Numbers of people seemed to come abroad, pretty much as people had come into the prison, through debt, through idleness, relationship, curiosity, and general unfitness for getting on at home. They were brought into these foreign towns in the custody of couriers and local followers, just as the debtors had been brought into the prison. They prowled about the churches and picture galleries, much in the old, dreary, prison yard manner. They were usually going away again, tomorrow or next week, and rarely knew their own minds, and seldom did what they said they would do, or went where they said they would go. In all this again, very like the prison debtors. They paid high for poor accommodation, and disparaged a place, while they pretended to like it, which was exactly the Marshalsea custom. They were envied when they went away by people left behind, feigning not to want to go. And that again was the Marshalsea habit invariably. A certain set of words and phrases, as much belonging to tourists as the college, and the snuggery belonging to the jail, was always in their mouths. They had precisely the same incapacity for settling down to anything, as the prisoners used to have. They rather deteriorated one another, as the prisoners used to do, and they wore untidy dresses, and fell into a slouching way of life. Still, always like the people in the Marshalsea. The period of the family's stay at Venice came, in its course, to an end, and they moved, with their retinue, to Rome. Through a repetition of the former Italian scenes, growing more dirty and more haggard as they went on, and bringing them at length to where the very air was diseased, they passed to their destination. A fine residence had been taken for them on the Corso, and there they took up their abode, in a city where everything seemed to be trying to stand still forever on the ruins of something else except the water, which, following eternal laws, tumbled and rolled from its glorious multitude of fountains. Here it seemed to Little Dorrit that a change came over the Marshalsea spirit of their society, and that prunes and prism got the upper hand. Everybody was walking about St. Peter's, and the Vatican on somebody else's cork legs, and straining every visible object through somebody else's sieve. Nobody said what anything was, but everybody said what the Mrs. Generals, Mr. Eustace, or somebody else said it was. The whole body of travelers seemed to be a collection of voluntary human sacrifices, bound hand and foot, and delivered over to Mr. Eustace and his attendants, to have the entrails of their intellects arranged according to the taste of that sacred priesthood. Through the rugged remains of temples, and tombs and palaces and senate halls, and theaters and amphitheaters of ancient days, hosts of tongue-tied and blindfolded moderns were carefully feeling their way, incessantly repeating prunes and prism in the endeavor to set their lips according to the received form. Mrs. General was in her pure element. Nobody had an opinion. There was a formation of surface going on around her on an amazing scale, and it had not a flaw of courage, or honest free speech in it. Another modification of prunes and prism insinuated itself on Little Dorrit's notice very shortly after their arrival. They received an early visit from Mrs. Myrtle, who led that extensive department of life in the Eternal City that winter, and the skillful manner in which she and Fanny fenced with one another on the occasion almost made her quiet sister wink, like the glittering of small swords. "So delighted," apostrophe said Mrs. Myrtle, "to resume an acquaintance so inauspiciously begun at Martigny." "Apostrophe, at Martigny, of course," apostrophe said Fanny. "Charmed, I am sure." "Apostrophe, I understand," apostrophe said Mrs. Myrtle, "from my son Edmund Sparkler, that he has already improved that chance occasion. He has returned quite transported with Venice." "Apostrophe, indeed?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe," returned the careless Fanny. "Was he there long?" "Apostrophe, I might refer that question to Mr. Dorrit," apostrophe said Mrs. Myrtle, turning the bosom towards that gentleman, Edmund having been so much indebted to him for rendering his stay agreeable. "Apostrophe, oh, pray don't speak of it," apostrophe returned Fanny. "I believe Papa had the pleasure of inviting Mr. Sparkler twice or thrice, but it was nothing. We had so many people about us, and kept such open house, that if he had that pleasure, it was less than nothing." "Apostrophe, except, my dear," apostrophe said Mr. Dorrit, "except how as it afforded me unusual gratification, to show by any means, however slight and worthless, the high estimation in which, in common with the rest of the world, I hold so distinguished and princely a character as Mr. Myrtle's." Apostrophe, the bosom received this tribute in its most engaging manner. "Mr. Myrtle," apostrophe observed Fanny, "as a means of dismissing Mr. Sparkler into the background, is quite a theme of Papa's, you must know, Mrs. Myrtle." "Apostrophe, I have been disappointed, madam," apostrophe said Mr. Dorrit, "to understand from Mr. Sparkler that there is no great probability of Mr. Myrtle's coming abroad." "Apostrophe, why, indeed," apostrophe said Mrs. Myrtle, "he is so much engaged, and in such request, that I fear not. He has not been able to get abroad for years. You, Miss Dorrit, I believe have been almost continually abroad for a long time." "Apostrophe, oh dear yes," apostrophe drawled Fanny, with the greatest hardihood. "An immense number of years." "Apostrophe, so I should have inferred," apostrophe said Mrs. Myrtle. "Exactly," apostrophe said Fanny. "I trust, however," apostrophe resumed Mr. Dorrit, "that if I have not the great advantage of becoming known to Mr. Myrtle on this side of the Alps or Mediterranean, I shall have that honor on returning to England. It is an honor I particularly desire, and shall particularly esteem." "Apostrophe, Mr. Myrtle," apostrophe said Mrs. Myrtle, who had been looking admiringly at Fanny through her eyeglass, "will esteem it, I am sure, no less." Apostrophe, little Dorrit, still habitually thoughtful and solitary, though no longer alone, at first supposed this to be mere prunes and prism. But as her father, when they had been to a brilliant reception at Mrs. Myrtle's, harped at their own family breakfast table on his wish to know Mr. Myrtle, with the contingent view of benefiting by the advice of that wonderful man in the disposal of his fortune, she began to think it had a real meaning, and to entertain a curiosity on her own part to see the shining light of the time. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.